Welcome to a special edition of Strategy Talk. I'm Dan Masterson, the publisher of Strategy Page. With me today are the associate editors, Austin Bay and Al Nofi.
Good morning, Al and Austin. Thought we'd take a little diversion this morning and learn from history, like we try to learn from history all the time. We sort of started talking among ourselves, and we go, and Austin and Al came up with this interesting concept of talking about the Seven Years' War and what we can learn from it. A lot of people may be asking out there, well, what the hell is the Seven Years' War and why the hell should I even care about it? We all know a little bit about it. I've written a little bit about it in one of the books I published with Jim. And Al, just set us up because
let me make a suggestion. We're recording this on February 14th. February 10th, right. Just 4 days ago, I think is the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Paris in 1763 that ended the Seven Years' War. So there is some historical topicality. All right.
Yeah.
All right. I didn't mean to interrupt. Just point that out
right.
At the top.
That's great.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Al. Just set us up of what the Seven Years' War was and what was happening at that time.
So basically, you have everything that happens after the Seven Years' War is a direct consequence of this war, globally. And it echoes today, even though we don't think about it. It starts as a little skirmish between England and France. England and France are in the middle of their second bout of nearly a century of warfare between the two of them, which is only going to end when Napoleon gets his. There's a French colony up there in Canada, and the French are trying to expand down into the Mississippi Valley and into the Ohio Valley. The Americans, of course, the British subjects in America, are pushing westward. So there's a clash in the woods near Pittsburgh, a young fellow named George Washington and a young French fellow, and this followed by 2 years of desultory frontier warfare that nobody notices. Meanwhile, in Europe, the English and the French, tensions are rising between them. Frederick the Great is England's really only ally left on the continent, and a huge war breaks out that's going to last 7 years, without counting the two in America, and arguably a couple more in the fringes in the rest of the world on the other end. And in 1759, it became known in British history as the Year of Miracles, Year of Victories. They win everywhere. India, Africa, West Indies, Europe, North America. They take Quebec City, which they've been trying to take, the British or their colonists have been trying to take since it was founded in 16-whatever. What does this do? This reduces France tremendously, French influence. It causes a complex realignment of power in Europe, because Frederick the Great practically gets it in the neck, and he's not happy about this, which effectively reduces Britain to no allies in Europe. But there's peace now, so it doesn't matter, right? France is pretty much bankrupt, and in the middle of this war, the unfortunate Louis XVI becomes king, and there's an alliance between France and Austria, which told you how far things are going, because the French and the Austrians have been fighting for 300 years, and it sets the stage for the American Revolution. Now, that's one part. Because the French colony up there in Canada had been like this monster sitting on the neck of the American colonies and keeping them loyal. There'd been unrest in the colonies for a long time. The colonies had proven themselves extremely effective, despite the British rhetoric, in organizing military expeditions, raising money, taxing their citizens, which we don't talk about. At the height of the Seven Years' War, something like 10% of the military manpower of the colonies was under arms. And in the northern colonies, the ones that were right up there, New England, right up against the French, it was higher. And they were drafting men, even. Now, the British didn't notice any of this. as far as they were concerned, the colonies had been wholly inept. And suddenly they're going to, well, now Britain's got this debt. And the British debt at the end of the 7 Years' War was probably the worst in their history. I mean, even worse than what they've got today. If you convert it into contemporary language and contemporary money and per capita, you know, liability to the crown. But Britain's been in debt since 1680, so it's not a big deal. So this sets off the, you know, the stage for the American Revolution. And you know, many of the people who are prominent in the American Revolution are prominent in the 7 Years' War. The two most notable are Benjamin Franklin, who was had been pushing for, you know, unity among the colonies within the British Empire, but still unity among the colonies for a decade or two already. And George Washington, who emerges as, you know, probably the most prominent single colonial recognizable in the world. And he's only a young man. He's, you know, when the war ends, he's only 31. He's, you know, he's the indispensable man that's going to show up again and again and again later. Now, other fronts, other things are developing. 7 Years' War is the point at which European military technology clearly outstrips that of any other part of the what I call the developed world. It's the first war in which, aside from, you know, cavalry swords, edged weapons are no longer considered vital to combat. No pikes are being used in this war anymore. Frederick the Great is the first general never to wear armor, not even for a portrait. I mean, this sounds dumb, but think about what was happening in other parts of the world. The Turks, the Indians, the Chinese, you know, these countries have been, these regions have been capable of putting up a stiff resistance. The Turks have been putting up a pretty stiff resistance to the, you know, it had only been about 80 years since they were at the gates of Vienna. They were seesawing back and forth in a series of wars in the Balkans with Austria. And 7 Years' War, following the 7 Years' War, the Turks are continuously in retreat now. Their technology is on. European firearms technology has reached a point where it dominates the battlefield worldwide. And that's why you find Clive in India in 1759, you know, wiping out armies, 30, 40,000 men with, you know, 2,000 Englishmen and 4,000 or 5,000 Indians trained to the English method. So this gives us, you know, opens the rest of the world to serious colonialism. You know, the first wave of colonialism was, you know, European expansion into places like South America and whatnot, where they didn't have any kind of firearms. So the technological edge was amazing, you know. The era of the so-called gunpowder empires, which included the Turks and the Mughals in India and the Moroccans in North Africa, for example. You know, they got guns and nobody else has guns. It's a big advantage. But then, of course, Europeans versus Turks, Europeans versus Mughals in India, Europeans versus North Africans, the technology is similar. And then by the 7 Years' War, it's no longer close. It's just this decisive edge in technology. Much better organization, much better equipment, better gunpowder, much superior gunpowder. So you have these three developments all at once. The first is the creation of the British Empire, as we know it. Yeah. They've been victorious everywhere. They had to give back some stuff that they owned to make nice with other countries. But they gained Canada. They have a huge chunk of India. They are now the decisive power in India. They control the West Indies except for two or three islands. That's the first. The second one is setting the British up for the American Revolution. And the third is just that in general, not just the British, but the Europeans in general, now have what is a significant edge in military technology and practice over the other powers. And that gives us the world as we know it. I mean, the countries that emerge in the 7 Years' War are going to dominate the world for the next two centuries. It only changes with the collapse of Germany as a great power and the disappearance of Austria in the First World War. So that's you know, how it starts. And for for us Americans, the big thing about the war is, you know, no taxation without representation. The Brits want to pay off their debt. And so there's, you know, a whole bunch of things involved here, because the first is that they refuse to accept the commitment made by the colonies, which in many colonies was huge. Massachusetts had the reputation among the colonies of kind of being like the Prussia of the American colonies. It was a bunch of hard-nosed Puritan militants, you know, and they held a regular draft. Expeditions north, even without the British government's permission, as early as the 1640s, 1650s. If there was a war with France, they were going to march north and try and capture Quebec. And they had captured Halifax, again, in the name of Louisbourg in Newfoundland. And the British gave it back in the 1640s. So they had it captured again. British had no willingness to accept the idea that the colonies had done their bit in the war. And so they're going to impose these restrictions and taxes. Now, the colonies really didn't mind paying. The key was that these were going to be imposed. You know, the phrase that people like to quote and never understand is no taxation without representation. It doesn't mean no taxation. It means without representation. And the Brits could have solved the problem, and it was even proposed at the time, of allowing the colonies to be represented in Parliament. And I can just imagine Benjamin Franklin getting up in Parliament and making a big speech, you know, or George Washington. And that would have, you know, seriously cooled the tensions for independence in the colonies. On the other hand, the British would continue to make the same mistakes over and over again during the Revolutionary War. They had a huge power base in portions of the colonies and could easily have made some good use of this, except that they had contempt for the colonies. Now, this is a normal imperialist pattern. If you look at some of the leading Latin American revolutionaries, for example, they only become revolutionaries because their path upwards in the imperial apparatus is limited by their colonial status. They want to be loyal to the mother country, but the mother country won't let them join the party, which is in contrast, of course, to the greatest empire builders in the ancient world, the Romans, where, you know, they conquer you this week and next week your son is elected consul or something, you know, or becomes a general, and he's considered a Roman. So the Brits had this problem even during the Revolutionary War. Contempt for the colonials, no sense of what the colonials had done for them. And then the other problem they have during, as a result of the Seven Years' War, is that during the Revolutionary War, they have no allies in Europe. Frederick the Great is pissed at them for abandoning him. And none of the other countries in Europe are willing to support Britain. And this is in marked contrast to previous wars, where the British are always able to find somebody in Europe to subsidize, to fight the French, or, you know, they used to subsidize the Spanish, then they subsidized the Austrians, then they, you know, to fight the French, then they, to fight the Spanish, they subsidized the Dutch, to fight the French, they subsidized the Dutch and the Spanish, and the Austrians, to fight the French, they subsidized Frederick. Now all of these countries are aligned against them at once. And even though only Spain and France actually jump into the war in the Netherlands, Frederick blocks recruiting of mercenaries. Catherine the Great refuses the British, flatly refuses the British permission to recruit troops in her lands. And so Britain is fighting alone. And actually does well in the American Revolution, except in the 13 colonies. So that's an impressive achievement. And the loss of the 13 colonies probably plays a major role in changing British attitudes towards other colonies. Now, it's still going to take nearly a century before Canada achieves independence within what is not yet called the British Commonwealth. But that's also tied into the growth of the United States and the fear the United States wants to conquer Canada, which doesn't dissipate until the Civil War. You know, after the Civil War, when it's clear that the United States, which now has a million troops under arms, is it's not interested in taking over Canada, you get the Dominion of Canada. So this war, which today is obscure, although when I went to school, we all learned about Wolfe dying on the Plains of Abraham and all that, Wolfe among Calm, of course, is so critically important, and yet it's 250 years ago, and it still has this forerunner. I mean, it's still an English-speaking nation that dominates the world, and has been since the Seven Years' War.
Right. It was the transition between Britain and the United States during the 20th century.
Yeah.
So, Austin, what are the lessons that we can draw from the Seven Years' War that apply to us today?
Well, one thing is that we have to make a quick comment on Al's fine and detailed dissertation on the Seven Years' War. This is a global event that sets in motion processes that, Al says, the dissolution of the German Empire changes the dynamics after the end of World War I. But take a look at the structure of the United Nations post World War II. You still see the prominence of Great Britain and the United States as well. There's the roots of Britain as a global power. Well, we can push them back to Queen Elizabeth I if you want, but the elements that the power and capabilities come together, and Al did that. Al was even talking about the technological component as well, are there in the Seven Years' War and the results of the Seven Years' War. Here, global is the one-word answer to your question. The British Prime Minister was Newcastle, who was sacked. Al will know more about the details of that, but basically he was incompetent. He was fired because of the British setbacks in the first year and a half, 2 years of the war. But he did, after he'd been fired, write a memorable line, which I'll paraphrase, which is Britain has events around the globe, places around the globe affect us. Therefore, we have interests in all of these places. He belatedly had an insight that the man who had who later replaced him, but had also been the previous Prime Minister, William Pitt. William Pitt had a global vision for Great Britain, trading power. He understood that the technology of 18th century ships. It's understand, Dan. It still took 6 months to get a message from London to East Asia. You're still operating on wind power. It took a little time gap, 6 months, 180 days to get a diplomatic transmission to East Asia. Long time, but he understood that Great Britain now and Europe, because of the ships, economic interests, things, events that happened in places very, very far away had impact on British life. And that is something that in the 2013, human beings are still wrestling with, because it's not just the lesson of 9/11 that New York and Washington can be attacked by religious extremists who are holed up in the Himalayas in a wild area of the Antarctic region of the Himalayas. There's an example of it, but in terms of economic dislocations, so-called globalization, jobs moving overseas, immediate exposure to news about events on a very direct and immediate and intimate basis, and where they're used because of either security interests, economic interests, outright humanitarian interests. You see that your own little, your own neighborhood has ties to the disparate places on the planet. 7 years war is an experience where at least the British, some of the British, are aware that this is now a feature of contemporary life. Now, Al correctly noted that I don't know if I was smiling when he said it. No taxation without representation. It's not a question of lack of taxes. Unwillingness to pay taxes, but nature of the American Revolution, that's why it's sometimes called a quote-unquote conservative revolution, it really is that, hey, we want to be treated like British citizens. And the Brits missed that component, as Al noticed, that otherwise you might have the United States of Canada now, and it would still be part of the British Empire. The notion there, that's a lesson for our era is that I'll pull out a term that cropped up after World War I, self-determination. We're still wrestling with what self-determination means. I mean, Woodrow Wilson certainly used it. It means different things to different people. But out of the debt crisis spawned by the 7 years war, you have the reaction by the American colonies, which is we want to have a say. We want to have a say in the way we're governed. And in this case, in the way that our economy, what we produce, is how that is handled by our government. And I'm saying that in 1765, our government for all of the American colonies was in London. They were loyalists. But the failure on the part of the British government to recognize, and I'll use here the necessity of a degree of self-determination, is I know darn well we see that play out in our world today. I mean, look, part of, this is not the core issue in Egypt right now, but Egypt's trying to figure out what self-determination for Egypt is. Down there, it's this modern, very modern information, integrated information and economic reality, integrated world that we live in. I see resonance out of the 7 years war, what comes out of the 7 years war in wrestling with what constitutes self-determination. One other thing, too, I'm going to just point this out. This really is, from a military historian's point of view, a remarkable war in the way that it really is truly a global war. I don't know if Al mentioned this, but in a British squadron takes Manila in the Philippines. The Philippines are given back to Spain in the peace settlement. Their actions all through, Al was describing all the actions throughout India, their actions in the Mediterranean, and then in the Caribbean, and also, I guess a comment on the making of the United States with the defeat of the French at Quebec by General Wolfe. The French had the American colonies boxed in. Suddenly, they're no longer boxed in. The expansion of the United States begins with the end of New France in 1763. That's not directly your question, but that's one of the remarkable outcomes of geostrategic outcomes of the Seven Years' War.
One of the other things that it's worth looking at, not just the Seven Years' War, but all everything that went before. You know, there's a sense, particularly among Americans, I think, but generally among moderns, that, you know, past is not important to us. Dave Surrett, who he was actually my doctor, he was a scholar of 18th century naval warfare on the sail, basically, although he slummed in the 20th century occasionally. He did a book on the Royal Navy's amphibious doctrine. And, you know, it peaks in the Seven Years' War. When the cabinet issues an order in January of 1762 for the capture of Havana, which is accomplished by September, and this is astonishing, you know. Literally, the order goes out, the Admiralty dispatches couriers, troops are concentrated, fleets, you know, converge from all over the damn place. And they capture the place, but it goes further than that. That's, you know, amazingly efficient staff work for the period, you know. And I would wonder if, you know, a frightening thought, could we do something like that today? You know? The other thing is, if you actually look at what they did, in other words, the fleet arrives off some place, right? Well, what happens next? And what happens next is almost exactly what happens in the Second World War. You know, the troops pile into the boats hit the beach, but the boats hit the beach in waves, commanded, you know, it's not just guys get into rowboats and row ashore. They're organized so that they can go ashore. The battleship, ships of the line, actually, provide covering fire if it's necessary, although because there's so much space, it's not necessarily necessary. Now think ahead a century and a half to 1915 and the disaster at Gallipoli. The Royal Navy completely forgot all that in between, because for nearly a century they hadn't been doing it. And here was this knowledge, this important skill that they completely forgot.
You know, did one other thing too, that since you're mentioning the Royal Navy success in the Seven Years' War. The Seven Years' War is a lesson in the strategic importance of naval power. That's the British had a, and Al, you're the naval historian here, but the British had really rebuilt the Royal Navy in the years prior to the Seven Years' War, and they've got a strategic asset that, yes, it's limited with what it can do vis-a-vis the continental powers in Europe, France, Prussia, but Britain is able to wage successful global war on the periphery without and that's where Britain's extraordinary success vis-a-vis France is in that instead of fighting you on the continent, we'll take your economic assets in North America and really take control of them in India as well, even though the French get some of those back. It's that's because of the Royal Navy's ability to control the seas at a distance and supply British Expeditionary Forces, including Clive. Al mentioned Clive in India. Yes, he had the edge because of the improvement in infantry weapons fired, and he had in training and the like. But he also had access to resupply from the Royal Navy and the British Merchant Fleet to resupply.
Well, one of the interesting things that, from my perspective, is Jim and I did a study of commanders, and one of the ones that we looked at was Frederick the Great, and how what he did has reverberated down through history from the standpoint of he started to make the German army or the Prussian army into a professional soldiers, and Frederick the Great was held up as an example of a scholar general to the German command, and even Hitler looks back to him as the example of what a commander should be, and that not only affects the German army, it ends up affecting the American army and how armies are now formed today, and the professionalism of our commanders and units and like that.
Yeah, Frederick is the first modern general to hold regular maneuvers. He starts in the 17 after the War of the Austrian Succession, so it's late 1740s or early 1780s. 1750s. And he does it pretty much every year. And his troops go out there and they play it, play at war. And this is, and he's really good. He doesn't win. He doesn't himself go out and win the battles, which is what Kaiser Wilhelm is going to do. He's very critical. And people begin to take notice. Now, it takes a long time for them to take notice. The British don't start holding regular maneuvers until the 1870s. That's a century, nearly a century and a half after Frederick. Can you imagine, right?
Yeah. One of my favorite stories from Frederick the Great, though, is when his cavalry is out exercising and there's a number of injuries, and I think there are a couple of men killed, and I can't remember the general he comments to and says, maybe we need to take it a little bit easier. And the general responds, you've got to crack a few eggs to make an omelet.
Yeah.
Let me make one comment on the British going to regular maneuvers after 1870. What happens in 1870 and 1871?
Oh, yeah.
Franco-Prussian
War. There's a
short novel. It's called The Battle of Dorking that appears in a British publication that is a futuristic war novel. It's the loss of the Britain. Britain loses a war to Prussia in 1875, and it's written as if it were written in the 1920s by a British veteran looking back at the loss of to the Prussians. And his scenario is, you can find most of this is online. I think it's actually available for free in a PDF now. Mm-hmm. But it's his scenario was that the Royal Navy was not present. It was off on global expeditions, and then the Prussians attacked and got across the Channel. Now, some of this is hedge, but his point was that we don't drill and we don't prepare for a worst case. And that had something to do with had a lot to do, actually, politically, with the revitalization of the British territorial troops and moving to annual army maneuvers. So they you could say that Britain's confidence was after 1763 and its the global reach of the Royal Navy demonstrated without question was that the fleet's going to stop any attack from the continent. And of course that was Napoleon's problem. Napoleon, he never tried to cross the channel to destroy the nation of shopkeepers because he couldn't. No Royal Navy was there. But I bring that up as that the British, the Royal Navy, global dominance. I mean, I don't think Al would dispute this at all. That's a global fact after 1763.
Yeah, I mean, Napoleon commented, wherever you find an inch of water, you find the British. Actually, said English, I think, but you know, send it for. But well, it's true.
Now, the other thing that Frederick does, too, is he's a great believer in technology, and he pushes it. And isn't he the one, Al, that actually starts introducing more mobile artillery, where before it had been fixed artillery?
Yeah, he introduces what we later call horse artillery, which is, of course, this tremendous shock to some of his enemies. He also develops the reserve system. Most armies in this period, well, no army has a reserve system. And what he does is he basically, actually it began with his father. Everybody in Prussia, every male in Prussia is registered with draft at 10. I know it sounds crazy, but thereafter, you know, when he turns, I forget what age, pretty much everybody is called up for a tour, and there are very few exceptions. You rarely serve more than a couple of months. What he does is the cadre of his army is built up primarily from foreigners. You know, in effect, he's got an army, the core of which is a bunch of mercs, you know. Or press gang folks in some cases. And every year he gets together, you know, the farm boys and the other folks and runs them through maneuvers just to make sure that everything's all right. And he's extremely critical. I forget one maneuver he compared the troops to a bunch of schoolgirls. Can you imagine the general saying that today and getting away with it? Because he was the king, so he could. But you know. he did that, and of course, it actually begun under his grandfather, partly because Prussia had been a doormat during the 30 Years' War. I mean, you know, Prussia was a state without boundary, without borders. No natural borders except an occasional river. So the armies can just march back and forth across Prussia. So his grandfather began building up a military system. And then his father, except for that his father built it on these super tall reveres. He had this thing about, you know, if you can be really tall, you're going to be a better soldier. So he recruited guys 6 foot and over from all over Europe, kidnapping and whatnot.
Right. The kidnapping was the thing that I found interesting. Yeah. They'd see a tall guy and they
kidnap him. They grabbed the priest right off his altar in Italy, you know, and smuggled him out of the country. You know. But the thing is, he didn't spend money on the rest of the army. And once Frederick came to power, he disbanded the tall guys. And say give him more money because they were very expensive. But they also had I forget, 40 years, I think, worth a stockpile of 40 years worth of grain. you know, ready ground grain, so that he had this, you know, food, plenty of food for the troops when we have to go to war. And similar loads, so to speak, of material, ammunition, firearms, because, you know, in those days it took a long time to make a weapon. And he invited people to his country to get the technology. That's why you got all these German generals with French names. You know, I think there's one that was the most brilliant one is von der Chevalier. Well, where did this German general come from? Well, he came from Frederick the Great inviting everybody and his brother to come to Prussia, and frequently with special privileges, in order to strengthen the state. The other thing that's interesting about Frederick is he came close to getting creamed in the Seven Years' War. And after that, he only went to war once. And that was about 1774 or 75 in the so-called War of the Bavarian Succession, because the throne of Bavaria came available, and there was some question about a deal between Austria and the claimant. Austria would give the claimant to the throne of Bavaria, Belgium, which the Austrians control in those days, in return for which Bavaria would be added to Austria. Well, if you know, if you're Frederick, doing the math, you know how bad this is, you know. So there was this very, very, very peculiar desultory war that lasted about 8 months, something like that. And it was called the Potato War. I don't think anybody was actually ever killed in the war, because the war started in the winter. So there was only limited troop movements, and those were mostly to capture stockpiles of food. And it was settled peaceably by the Austrians keeping Belgium and Wittelsbach family being put on the throne of Bavaria. So, but Frederick did not go to war again, the point is, after the Seven Years' War, because he'd come so close to disaster.
Hmm. Now, one of the things, Austin, we briefly touched on it, but I think it's going to become a bigger and bigger component in the coming years, is the influence of Britain on India, because India is this, you know, sleeping, some people may call sleeping elephant there, as opposed to the dragon mm-hmm. to its north. But because of that English influence on India, that's probably going to affect geopolitics for quite some time, correct?
That is certainly an outcome of the 1763. Understand that some of the French possessions in India are returned to them under the settlement, but Great Britain is left as the power in the Indian Ocean. Again, it's the part of the strength of the Royal Navy, but they have control of Bengal and Calcutta. By the way, it's the Black Hole of Calcutta is a 7 Years' War event. Al, I don't think you mentioned that, did you, Al? That was Black Hole of Calcutta, but occurs in the 7 Years' War as part of the intrigues involving British forces and with various. Rajas and Nawabs, I think that was the term that actually in that portion of India. But Britain is left as the preeminent European, preeminent foreign power in India, and this is certainly having. Britain is left as the preeminent foreign power in North America, in the entirety, with the exception of Mexico. Vast portions of the globe are under, if not, they're not necessarily direct British control, but British influence, extraordinary amount of British economic and political influence, if not direct military control. And that's something that's certainly working out, as you point out, with the growing recognition of India's, I wouldn't just say potential, but expressed power. And curiously enough, even though the Indians, their resentment of British imperialists is still fresh, still expressed with great anger, if you see it in the Indian newspapers, all of the major ones, of course, written in English, because English is the, bad pun coming, lingua franca of India. It's what gives India as a whole that's how India communicates with itself, is in English. But it's what has produced at least the spine of an interesting alliance, where with Australia, Singapore, and India having a great deal of interaction, and the distant discussions of U.S. and Indian cooperation, despite the legacy of the quote-unquote U.S. tilt towards Pakistan. Pakistan has got many of its own internal problems, India sees China on the other side of the Himalayas, in some cases not necessarily the other side of the Himalayas, because there's still some unsettled elements of the 1962 Sino-Indian War. And the United States is in many ways a logical ally for India. You don't have to believe me. The Chinese certainly think so. And it's some of it has to do with the commonality of language. So right. That's India is not left under direct British control. Goa is still a Portuguese colony on the west coast. But very much, I mean, that's still Goa, still there until, when does Nehru knock Goa off? Early
1962.
Yeah. 62. That's
62. It's like a 24-hour war.
Yeah. Well, he finally knocks off Goa, which is the Portuguese trading colony there. But, the outcome of the 7 Years War, our topic, from which we have wandered greatly in many ways, but, is,
right.
Well, that's 250 years, man. Yeah, come on, 250 years, you're going to wonder greatly. I mean, the fact is, I thought it was fascinating to get back and talk about, you know, the influences of Frederick the Great, and he's the continental player in the 7 Years' War. But then the cultural and the political legacy of Great Britain in the subcontinent has, there are many Indians now who see that just like the United States, one of the benefits of having been a British colony in many ways are extraordinary, especially one of the legacies of a relatively free media, relatively free in being able to express your opinion, and that's freedom of information. And that has a real economic payoff. Indians realize that. We in the United States even put that in our Constitution and our First Amendment Bill of Rights. And to some degree, it's a legacy of Great Britain.
Why don't you put a bow on this for us, and we'll wrap it up.
Well, I think it's interesting that these great events that fell out of the 7 Years' War, I mean, clearly these are important developments, and yet we tend not to notice, not to remember the war. We forget history. And sometimes, yeah, it is sometimes rather esoteric. You know, what's the point? But at other times, there's a lot of points. Forgetting the implications of of the long-term fallout of events, the lessons of events. Not so much the specific event, in other words, because this happened, this will, you know, then this will happen now, but rather things like being able to explore the consequences. You know, if this were to happen, what could we do? What are the potential consequences? We don't do that very often. We don't discuss those kinds of things. You know. Presidents will haul economists into the White House when the economy is having hiccups, but you rarely hear of a president, you know, calling up a historian to ask him a question about some country he's dealing with. You know,
right? well, and I think, Al, I had a discussion with a friend yesterday at lunch about this very thing, and that is that I think that's a failure of our educational institutions to view history as cut and dried facts, and that if we taught history in a different way to our students, which I'm sure you did when you taught history.
Yeah, I had my kids, just to break in and blow my own horn, I had my kids do things like have disarmament negotiations. And I would, you're the good guys and you're the bad guys, and so, you know, the Russians are the Americans, you know, and this is the deal you want to get. Of course, you want to get, make sure that the deal works in your favor. And then each side would get a secret briefing. You know, you're kind of okay in this department. So if you want to give that away, that's okay. You know, and they would get. I mean, they would literally get into it. I'm very proud that at least one of my students became a historian. And considering the area I taught in, getting most of my kids out of school was an important development. The fact that one of them went on to become a historian is helpful, but yeah, the idea that we need to test people. Well, you know, listen, I can recite all the presidents, and I can recite all the Roman emperors, and I can recite, you know, the kings of England, and who cares?
Right.
I mean, why bother? Because it isn't the individuals; it's what they did. Now, if you can, you know, set it up so that I'm discussing, you know, I am asking my kids. Who the king of England, who became king of England in 1066, but rather asking them, what are the consequences of this guy becoming king of England? You know,
right.
It's a big difference. And unfortunately,
right.
the mandatory testing thing harms that tremendously. It's just really, we should never get a chance to get our kids to understand what's happened rather than just to know a fact per se. But as I say, the president should be hauling historians in. Let the historians argue it out. It doesn't mean that he has to listen to them, because the point is that they don't necessarily agree either. But he can get more perspective. One of the heartening things in our defense establishment is the extent to which a large number of military people do history well, because it gives them a much better perspective on places than perhaps most of our political leaders have had. Because our political leaders watch the History Channel, and I don't care which party they're in. You know, they watch the History Channel, and you know, and this week it's the 17th installment of the Orgies of the Roman Empire or something. Well, if they were spending all their time having orgies, how do they build this empire?
Right.
This empire. So somebody must have been doing something, you know, besides diddling the maid.
Right.
And anyway, I'm rambling.
Yeah. Well, we'll wrap it up there. And it was good talking to you again, and talking with Austin. And we'll talk to you again in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.